KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump celebrated his first 100 days in Michigan. He was in a county that voted for him, and that's also affected by his tariffs. We hear from the county executive in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Republicans in Congress want to alter the way students pay for college. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Several proposals would make student loan programs less generous. One goal is to find savings to offset tax cuts. Also, we hear from Ho Chi Minh City, the city once known as Saigon, 50 years after the Vietnam War. It's Wednesday, April 30th. This day in 1789, George Washington gave his inaugural address. He told members of Congress that the new government was an experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is marking 100 days in office this week. He rallied last night with supporters outside Detroit. Trump celebrated his numerous executive actions targeting subjects from immigration to tariffs. But NPR's Tamara Keith says Trump also noted some critics are opposed to what he's doing.
Last night, Trump complained repeatedly about polls he said he couldn't possibly be valid. That's the raft of public polls out in recent days indicating Trump has the lowest approval rating at the 100 days mark of any president in 80 years. And like in his first term, significant parts of Trump's agenda are being held up in the courts. The courts and the polls are the two biggest hints of gravity that Trump is experiencing right now.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. The federal government says growth in the U.S. economy shrank in the first 3 months of this year. The U.S. economy declined 0.3% from what it was a year ago. That's very different from the annual 2.4% U.S. economic growth seen in the last 3 months of last year. The S&P 500 stock market index is down 7% since the president took office. That is the worst performance during a president's first 100 days in office in several decades. NPR's Laura Walmsley reports many Americans have been anxious about their retirement accounts.
Laura Anderson is 61 and teaches at a university in Cincinnati. She had been planning to retire in 5 or 6 years, but the market turmoil has given her pause, even after finding that her 401k hadn't dropped as much as she feared.
I just feel like there's so much uncertainty right now that I still don't feel like my original retirement plan is going to be doable.
Amy Rowland of Salt Lake City shares that uncertainty.
Part of me retiring is kind of that feeling of, yeah, it is probably time for my generation to step aside, but we can't do it if we don't think we can survive our retirement years.
It's a feeling that may cause those who can to keep working. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News.
President Trump has opened a new front in his battle with the media. He has targeted the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. NPR's David Folkenflik reports the CPB is now suing the White House.
The White House sent an email to three of the five members of the CPB board saying they had been fired and thanking them for their service. Thing is, it's not clear Trump has the power to do that. As it noted in legal filings, federal law states the CPB is not a government agency. The attempted firings are part of Trump's larger effort to strip public broadcasting of taxpayer funds. He says he'll ask Congress to pull back more than $1 billion already allocated by lawmakers for public broadcasting for the next 2 years. PBS and its member stations rely on federal funds from CPB for 15% of their revenues. For NPR member stations, it's 10% on average. NPR itself receives just 1% directly and a bit more indirectly in fees paid by stations. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A federal judge is opening a hearing this morning in Vermont. Columbia University student Mohsen Mahdawi is asking to be released from federal detention. His lawyers say the Trump administration is trying to deport him for political activism. Immigration officials want Mahdawi to remain behind bars. He has not been charged with any crime. The only predominantly black, all-female unit to serve in Europe during World War II has now been awarded a Congressional Gold Medal. One unit member was Puerto Rican, another was Mexican. NPR's Rachel Treisman has more.
The 6888, as it's called, was a mostly black, all-female unit that made history by deploying to England in early 1945. Their mission was to sort through backlogs of undelivered mail for American service members. The women worked around the clock to clear some 17 million pieces of mail in just 3 months, half the expected time. After working in France, they returned home in 1946 without any public recognition for decades. Congress bestowed the award and President Biden signed the law in 2022. Only two of the 855 women lived to see this medal ceremony. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
Severe thunderstorms in Pennsylvania yesterday have killed two people. Two men died by electrocution in separate incidents. Both were affected by live power lines. Weather forecasters say the powerful storms had gusts that reached hurricane strength. The tracking site, poweroutage.us, says nearly 450,000 customers in Pennsylvania do not have electricity. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Coming up, we learn about the owls that come in for a landing at Boston's Logan Airport.
Who is going to do that story? Anyway, today marks 100 days since President Trump took office, and last night he celebrated with a rally in Michigan.
We've accomplished more in 3 months than most administrations accomplished in 4 years or even 8 years, and we're just getting started. Believe me, we're just getting started.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith has this look at what has changed since Trump's first term.
When Trump came into office in 2017, it was a shock to the political system. But his first term looks downright tame compared to 100 days of Trump 2.0. And a lot of that has to do with Trump putting his stamp, or rather his large Sharpie signature, on the government and the nation's institutions with incredible speed and intensity. It started on Inauguration Day, as Staff Secretary Will Scharf presented him with one executive action after another.
The first item that President Trump is signing is the rescission of 78 Biden-era executive actions, executive orders, presidential memoranda, and others.
And he did it all in a sports arena packed with cheering supporters.
Could you imagine Biden doing this? I don't think so.
These signings have become a near daily occurrence in Trump's White House, and they've led to far more dramatic and immediate action than the first time around, reshaping the government and seeking retribution against his political enemies. Trump even changed the name of the body of water that borders America's southern states.
You know, we're flying over right now. We're flying over a thing called the Gulf of America.
Just like his first term, Trump is dominating the national conversation. But this time, he's meeting with less resistance.
By the way, he's enjoying the hell out of himself at this point, too.
David Urban is a longtime Trump ally.
The president is much more confident in his own abilities, in his understanding of what needs to be done and how to pull the levers and make things happen.
Doug Sosnick was a senior advisor in the Clinton White House, and he says he expected Trump would transform Washington in a way that he didn't in his first term.
Now, having said that, never in my wildest dreams did I think for a moment that Trump would come in and do what he's done.
He says Trump's public fights with allies have upended America's relationship with the world. The president took his tariff ambitions much further and much faster this time around, sending consumer confidence into a tailspin. Trump is also pushing the limits of presidential power, a fight now playing out in the courts. But Sosnick says there is a risk in Trump's aggressive approach to the presidency this time around.
Just doing a lot of stuff doesn't necessarily make you successful.
During Trump 1.0, he faced pushback from within his own administration. The second Trump administration is all loyalists. Gone are the establishment Republicans who saw themselves as guardrails working behind the scenes to temper his plans. Congress is more compliant as well. Back in 2017, there were Republicans like Arizona Senator Jeff Flake who openly questioned what Trump was doing in this Washington Post video.
I think the Republican Party is in a crisis.
But Flake and Republicans like him aren't in Congress anymore. The Republican majorities in the House and Senate are far more willing to go along with Trump's demands. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski is a rare Republican still willing to oppose Trump, but only sometimes.
We are all afraid.
At an event earlier this month in Alaska, she said she was anxious about speaking up.
Because retaliation is real.
Trump's approval rating at 100 days has fallen to the lowest of any president in 80 years. And in the sprint to do everything all at once, there have been mistakes. Tariffs on an island inhabited only by penguins, firing critical employees only to have to beg them to come back. Top national security officials talking about military attack plans on a group chat that a prominent journalist had been added to by mistake. Billionaire Elon Musk, charged with cutting the federal bureaucracy, conceded there would be mistakes.
Some of the things that I say will be incorrect and should be corrected. So nobody's going to bat 1,000.
But unlike in Trump 1.0, so far at least, no heads have rolled in the upper ranks of the administration. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Macomb County, Michigan, where the president spoke last night, is a classic swing county. It voted twice for Barack Obama and then three times for Donald Trump. But while voting for Trump, the county also voted for Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer and for Mark Hackle, who is the Democratic County Executive and our next guest. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Steve.
What is Macomb County like for those who haven't been? I'm looking at the map. You're outside Detroit.
Yeah, we're outside Detroit. I mean, obviously, we border Lake St. Clair, just north of the city of Detroit. And, about a million people, just closing in on a million people as far as population. Heavily automotive. We're very strong on defense. And, you know, we've got about 1,600 manufacturers. You know, they employ about 70,000 individuals. So, you know, it's a strong workforce that we have here. And, you know, just kind of one of those communities that, you know, when it comes to our politics, as you just got through mentioning, you know, they kind of differ. You know, sometimes they'll favor the Democratic side, the Republican side. And, you know, it's swung over more to the conservative side as of the past probably 10 years than we've ever seen before.
So classic blue collar county. And you mentioned another thing that's very interesting. It's common for us to say we don't make anything anymore in America. People actually make things in Macomb County, Michigan. Residents in Macomb County make things.
Yeah, about 10 years ago when manufacturing was a challenge, we doubled down on it. And I think we're manufacturing more things as a result.
How do the president's early actions match with people's expectations in your county that voted for him?
Yeah, I think a lot of anxiety, you know, across the board, whether it's in education departments, people that provide, you know, some assistance to others, you know, the issues dealing with DEI. You know, there's a lot of concerns with our manufacturers, automotive, even in defense. And so, you know, some of those policies, I think, had a lot of people up in arms and, you know, concerned. And I think it was not weighing in his favor during that time.
What do the automotive tariffs specifically mean for people in Macomb County?
Interesting enough, we've talked to a lot of our manufacturers and even some of the big three. We're having more conversation with them. We're constantly conversing with them to find out what this means. I think they're trying to make a determination, you know, what is real, what is not. You know, sometimes, he says something, he's negotiating with himself. So many of them are taking a measured approach here in Macomb County, kind of see what's happening, but also trying to make some of those adjustments in case they, you know, what he says is the direction he's going in, which makes them very concerned.
Are people feeling paralyzed then?
You know, I don't know if it's paralyzed. They're still trying to figure out how do they manage what they're doing, trying to provide, you know, the connections that they can, and making sure that they're, you know, sourcing things the way they need to source them, trying to make sure they're providing the outputs of the products. They're still trying to do what they normally have done, but I think the big concern is, you know, what is the cost associated with it and how they pass it along to a customer.
Yeah, I guess we should just remind people the auto industry has set itself up in such a way that products move across the border from Canada and from Mexico to the United States back and forth as cars are assembled. The components come from lots of places. The assembly's done a lot of places. That's really complicated. It's hard to mess with. But when I talk with people in the Midwest, where I'm from, sometimes I hear people say, okay, fine, this is all complicated, but too many manufacturing jobs have gone away. We need a reset. We need something drastic. Do you hear people in your county saying, you know, I don't know what the solution is, but we needed to do something drastic?
Yeah, that's definitely part of the conversation. You know, even the United Auto Workers, you know, they're pretty much, you know, they're applauding the tariffs, and which was kind of surprising. We weren't sure exactly, you know, what that meant. But, you know, Sean Fain was out there, you know, kind of crediting the president for doing that. So
he's been on this program talking about it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he actually lives in Macomb County, as a matter of fact. So, you know, that being said, you know, you're trying to figure out, okay, what does this really mean? You've got, which you usually would think there'd be opposition on behalf of the auto workers supporting, you know, the president's ideas of, you know, bringing these companies, these jobs back to the United States, and in particular the state of Michigan.
I've just got about 15 seconds, but we had an economist on the program today talking about a recession drawing closer. Are you preparing for economic hard times?
Yeah, we've heard about that. We've talked to economists, and they tend to think that if there is a recession, Macomb County is going to do pretty well through that process, but it's definitely going to be something that's concerning to us.
Mark Hackel is the Democratic County Executive in Macomb County, Michigan, where President Trump spoke last night. Thanks so much, sir.
Thanks, Steve.
The snowbirds are heading north again, and no, this is not about the Canadians who winter in Florida. Snowy owls fly south from the Arctic to spend the winter at a Boston airport.
You know, Logan Airport is an area that is 1,800 acres of short-mowed grass that looks very much like the Arctic tundra.
Norman Smith studies birds like the snowy owl that catch prey.
They actually eat a lot of ducks and rodents that are on the airfield. So there's plenty of food, and it probably looks more like home to them than any place else around.
Smith started volunteering with the organization Mass Audubon in 1966, and today he conducts research on raptors for the organization.
And he's become an expert on the Logan Airport owls. Smith says that before he got involved, the airport had a very different way of dealing with the birds.
The FAA made it mandatory that airports have to create a bird patrol, which keeps airports bird-free, or as bird-free as they can. And the goal and objective back then was to shoot birds that were on the airport, because obviously you don't want a bird to get caught in an engine of a plane.
In 1981, Smith wrote a letter to the airport asking if he could take a different approach, a more humane approach.
Well, I started going out there and studying the snowy owls and then trapping them and removing them from the airport for the safety of the owl and for the safety of the aircraft there as well. And I've relocated over 900 snowy owls so far from Logan Airport.
Amazing. The birds are usually released far away from the airfield in Cape Cod or the North Shore. Smith is the only owl catcher at Logan Airport, although other airports are following his lead.
We wrote a protocol which was adopted by the USDA, and that protocol was to live trap and remove birds, which was accepted at most of the airports, you know, throughout the United States now and Canada.
And right now is about the time of year when the snowy owls start to fly back to the Arctic. They usually return in the fall, and Smith plans to greet them at the airport again when they do. This is NPR News.
A once fringe movement to increase birth rates is exploding into the mainstream, but it's not just about having more babies. On the next Fresh Air, we'll explore the politics of pronatalism, from Elon Musk's crusade against population collapse to ideas about genetic engineering and the so-called Great Replacement. We'll speak to NPR's Lisa Hagen and demographer Karen Guzzo. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at ProgressiveCommercial.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. House Republicans are sharing details of their plan to make big changes to the federal student loan system and cut spending along the way. Their plans affect repayment options and Pell Grants and also offers a new way to hold colleges accountable. NPR education correspondent Corey Turner is lending us some of his time to talk about this. Corey, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What are the proposals, which we should clarify are not yet law?
Yeah, well, it's hard to overstate just how much Republicans want to do here. They want to eliminate PLUS loans for graduate students. They also want to cap parent PLUS loans for parents who are going to help their kids pay for college.
Okay.
And then they want to eliminate subsidized loans for undergraduate students. This is a big one. That means, Steve, in the future, if you take out a loan to go to college, the government would no longer cover the interest while you're in school.
Oh, big change. Okay.
Yeah. And then there are changes to the rules for Pell Grants, which are for low-income students, don't need to be paid back. Republicans want to expand the program to give students access to use Pell to cover short-term workforce training, but they also want to make it harder to qualify for a full Pell award by increasing the number of credit hours a student has to take each year. And then there's one more big change here when it comes to the aid students get, and that is a seismic shift in borrowers' repayment options. Republicans want to simplify things down to really two basic repayment plans. There's a standard plan with a fixed monthly payment, looks a lot like the old. But then there is what they're calling a repayment assistance plan that bases monthly payments on borrower's income. But unlike the old income plans that offered forgiveness after 20 or 25 years, this new one could last for 30.
Oh, that's interesting. So every one of these details doesn't matter much if you don't have a student loan, but could affect your payments if you're going into college, if you're thinking about this, if you have experience with student loans. And what is the change on the university side, the colleges that get paid?
Yeah, there's a really big idea here Republicans are putting out. They're proposing what they're calling skin in the game accountability for colleges. Basically, if colleges and universities want access to the federal student loan program, which, trust me, Steve, they do, they're going to have to agree to reimburse the government for a share of the debt when their students don't repay their loans.
Hmm.
While Republicans are pushing this new way to hold schools accountable, though, they are also planning to end some pretty important past protections for students, especially for borrowers who attend schools that close suddenly and for borrowers who say they were defrauded by their schools.
What's the goal of all these changes?
Well, there are really two end goals here. You know, Republicans have been talking for a while about wanting to reform the student loan system to make it simpler, but also to try to use the levers of government to rein in rising college costs. The other goal is Republicans want to extend President Trump's massive tax cuts. So Republican committee chairs in the House were told to come up with deep cuts that could offset the high cost of those tax cuts. Education Committee Republicans say these changes to federal student aid will help them save more than $330 billion. For their part, Democrats have uniformly decried these cuts, saying they're about tax cuts for the rich, and they will make it harder for low-income students to pay to college.
Corey, thanks very much for the update. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Steve.
That's NPR's Corey Turner, who's covering proposed changes to student loans.
The Trump administration has dismissed hundreds of scientists working on the National Climate Assessment. It's the most influential source of information about how climate change affects the U.S. Rebecca Hersher from NPR's Climate Desk has more.
The National Climate Assessment authors are all volunteers. Scientists, economists, sociologists, tribal leaders, business leaders, people with all different kinds of expertise who spend years writing a massive report. Melissa Kenny of the University of Minnesota is one of those authors.
It is one of the most rigorous scientific products produced in the world.
Kenny has helped write two previous editions, and she was supposed to lead one of the chapters of the next edition, due in 2027, as mandated by Congress, until she and the rest of the 400 or so authors got an email from the Trump administration this week, dismissing her from her role. The paid staff who help coordinate the authors' work were already let go earlier this month, which means work on the climate assessment has ground to a halt. Dave White is a researcher at Arizona State University and has worked on two previous editions of the report.
I think the reason that Americans should be upset and should be concerned about this decision is because it is more than just a report.
For one thing, it's written in plain language, so anyone can use it. And a lot of people rely on it, says White, from farmers and ranchers to judges and teachers, and a lot of local governments.
For example, city water utilities, as they prepare to address the impacts of sustained drought and climate impacts on water supplies. It informs elementary schools as they help to develop heat mitigation plans to reduce the risks of extreme heat on children.
And the assessment has chapters about each region in the country, because climate change means different things depending on where you live, says Rachel Cletus of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
It's important to understand what and who is at risk, not just in a general sense, but in a very localized sense, what's happening around the country. Without that information, you know, we'd be flying blind.
Cletus was working on a section about the coastline, in particular, how to adapt to sea level rise. Sea levels are generally going up, but how much they're rising depends on where you live. It could be inches, could be feet. The National Climate Assessment allows anyone to zoom in and see what's happening in their town. And the new edition is supposed to have the most up-to-date information. But for now, work has halted. The White House did not respond to questions about the future of the National Climate Assessment. Dave White says suspending work on the report is dangerous and
will put Americans' lives at risk, the economy at risk, reduce our ability to respond to climate change, and reduce our competitiveness in the global economy.
Climate change kills thousands of Americans each year and will present new economic challenges and opportunities for businesses in the U.S. That's according to the last National Climate Assessment. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Weeks ahead of extreme weather season in the U.S., the Trump administration canceled billions in weather disaster funding. The shift from federal to local leaves more people in small towns in harm's way.
Guys, this is dangerous. Our sewer plant is going to continue to overflow.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, staying safe with less federal support on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump says he's accomplished more in 3 months than most presidents accomplish in 4 years. That was his message last night at a rally in Michigan, where the president marked the first 100 days of his second term in the White House. The president promoted his efforts to secure the U.S. southern border, to downsize the federal government, and to implement tariffs to help the U.S. economy. The most recent poll from NPR, PBS News, and Marist shows most Republicans give Trump an A on his job performance. 80% of Democrats and 49% of independents give the president a failing grade. The president's former advisor, Steve Bannon, says Trump is doing much of the work Congress should have been doing over the last few decades.
If Congress had been doing its job on trade and tariffs over the last, let me just guess, I don't know, since they allowed China to come in as the World Trade Organization, they would have some backup from people say, yeah, you know, we should get Congress in here because they've done such a great job. What has Congress done? The House and Senate have rolled over to the globalists for 30 or 40 years.
He was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. Despite the president's optimism, the Commerce Department reports the U.S. economy shrank in the first quarter by 0.3%. This is NPR News. Word of the U.S. economy shrinking in the first quarter comes a day after the Conference Board reported consumer confidence in April hit its lowest level since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. It's fallen for five consecutive months, with more Americans saying they're pessimistic about their financial future. A spokesman for Pakistan's military is warning that India plans to carry out airstrikes on his country in the coming days. NPR's Dia Hadid in Mumbai says tensions between the two nuclear-armed countries have been heightened since gunmen killed 26 people in Indian-controlled Kashmir last week.
The gunmen attacked tourists in a meadow in Indian-controlled Kashmir last Tuesday, killing mostly Hindu men. Since then, there's been exchanges of fire across the de facto border that divides a territory of Kashmir between India and Pakistan. And overnight, a Pakistani daily reported that the military shot down two drones near that de facto border. Then Pakistan's military spokesman said they had credible evidence, quote, that India intends carrying out military action against Pakistan in the next 24 to 36 hours. India has not responded to the claims, but local media reported that the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, told a meeting of top security chiefs that they had operational freedom to respond. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. People in Vietnam are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War today in Ho Chi Minh City, formerly known as Saigon. On April 30th, 1975, the North Vietnamese Army entered the city and took control of South Vietnam after almost 20 years of war and about 2 years after American troops left. Joining us to talk about the ceremony marking this 50th anniversary is journalist Na Pham in Ho Chi Minh City. Hi.
Hello. Good morning, Leila.
So tell us about the ceremony and who attended.
Well, thousands of people gathered on the streets in Ho Chi Minh City early this morning. The ceremony started with a speech by the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam, Tô Lâm. He called for national unity and support for the Communist Party's economic policies. and it was attended by top leaders and international guests, including the president of Laos and the top leader of Cambodia, Hun Sen. But the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam was not on the podium, and this led to some disappointment amongst the Vietnamese. Because the U.S. and Vietnam have become close partners in recent years, and people do expect foreign friends to join these celebrations.
So you said diplomats from the U.S. weren't there. Why not?
Well, the U.S. ambassador was not there because it was reported that the Trump administration told U.S. diplomats in Vietnam not to attend any event in Ho Chi Minh City and Hanoi. But at the last minute, I think the restriction was eased. So the consul general in Ho Chi Minh City, Susan Burns, was actually present at the parade today.
What do Vietnamese people today think about marking this 50th anniversary?
Well, it's a big public holiday here. So walking around Ho Chi Minh City, you could actually feel the excitement of a street party. Mm. And people were wearing red, the national color of Vietnam, of course, waving the flag and playing patriotic songs. It was almost like carnival. I spoke to a local resident, Phuong Nghiem.
I came here at 4 a.m. in the morning. It's a grand ceremony for the whole country. The entire country united together. So I would like to see the marching, the helicopter. It's awesome.
It's also a very successful PR campaign by the government here to try to reignite a sense of deep respect for the military felt by previous generations, especially during wartime.
So it sounds like marking this anniversary has brought up a lot of national pride.
That's right. You can really tell that people here are very proud of the country's past struggles. They went against the French, the Americans, and the Chinese. But also they are equally proud of what they have achieved so far, 50 years after the war. So I spoke to veteran American journalist Jim Lorry, who actually covered the Vietnam War for NBC and witnessed the fall of Saigon.
There's no real sense of history in what's going on today. It's a grand celebration, but I see in the Vietnamese a tremendous pride and a celebration of what they've become, not what they were.
Well, the people are very proud, but of course, Vietnam is facing a lot of serious challenges, especially in developing their economy. There's an enormous task for the ruling Communist Party. They will have to improve people's standard of living in order to maintain legitimacy. And people are really worried about trade because most of the country's income comes from exports.
Na Pham joining us from Ho Chi Minh City. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's hear a reporter who covered the Vietnam War, Lauren Jenkins, who had never expected to be there.
I didn't want to be a war correspondent. I thought I'd be a film critic. But but the big stories of my generation were wars.
In later years, Lauren Jenkins was NPR's foreign editor, a white-bearded Ernest Hemingway sort of figure here at NPR. But in April 1975, he was in Saigon reporting for Newsweek.
The North was beginning to fold up what little South Vietnamese resistance there was, and moving south was a big crowd of refugees trying to flee the North. It was just slowly unrolling. We knew it was going to end in Saigon. There was nothing to stop them. The embassy had evacuation plans. They were going to broadcast "I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas" on the military radio system as a code to evacuate.
Huh.
Some of us in the press, I mean, we were told to go out to the airport and jump on a plane and get out of there. Some of us thought that was sort of stupid, that as long as it was an American embassy, we were going to see that fold up.
I'm just trying to imagine the American embassy in Saigon. I guess there's a compound, there's some grounds.
Big wall, six-story building, flat roof. When I got in through the main gate, that was guarded by Marines and hundreds of Vietnamese trying to get in, hoping to be evacuated because they were compromised for having worked with the Americans. The Americans preparing to, you know, get rid of all their security files. There were stuff streaming out of the embassy windows, ticker tape, shredded documents. A couple of security guards came down with a load of dollars to burn in the incinerator. That clearly had come from the CIA main office.
Didn't want the $100 bills to fall in enemy hands.
Yeah, because there was a lot of smoke coming out of a lot of windows as they were burning documents. By then, they had been helicoptering people off the roof. There were Vietnamese generals, the Saigon fire chief, and, you know, Vietnamese that had worked for Americans who wanted to leave before they were sent off to re-education camps.
Yeah.
The ambassador lowered the flag around 4 a.m. in the morning, folded it into a nice triangle, moved up with his secretary and his pet dog to the roof. He got in one helicopter, put the secretary and the dog in another, and they flew off. And then a couple of us journalists that were still there, we flew off in the helicopter after him.
Having covered so many years of the war, and then having seen the very, very end, what thoughts passed through your mind about it all?
Oh, I was just glad it was over. It was a stupid war. It never should have been waged. It was vicious and nasty to everybody, to the Americans who were set to fight it, and to the poor Vietnamese who had us bomb them. I filed my last story and flew to Bali to sit on a beach with Hunter Thompson and look out at sea and talk about the past.
Do you think Americans learned anything from that bitter experience?
No. The problem is Washington. They're intellectually not aware of what their actions really do. The policymakers rarely go to the places they're making policy about. And I think that's the problem.
Lauren Jenkins, it's a great pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you.
This is NPR News.
We'll check in with the voters who turned out for President Trump in November. How do they think he's doing after the first 100 days? That's next time, Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. They say news travels fast, so the favorite to win this year's Kentucky Derby should be obvious, a horse named Journalism. The news-making stallion is a 3-1 favorite in the race this Saturday. Won't be easy. Right at his tail are Sovereignty and Sandman with 5-1 and 6-1 odds, and he'll have to deal with competition from Owen Almighty and American Promise. Personally, I support Journalism. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Generations of workers in this country found a path into the middle class through federal government jobs, and that includes a lot of black people in this country. The Trump administration's job cuts are now throwing that sense of stability up in the air. NPR's Hansilo Wong met with one such worker.
Shirley Hopkins built careers for countless other black workers.
This is one of the awards that I got.
And she has the plaques from the federal government to prove it.
I was puffed up.
And it was for promoting equal opportunity.
Equal opportunity.
Before she retired from the National Institutes of Health, she was known as the recruitment lady. She made it her mission to encourage more black students in the Washington, D.C. area to apply for the agency's internship and youth employment programs.
It was equal opportunity for those who really didn't have. You were able to get them a chance to get into the federal government.
Hopkins first got into NIH back in the 1960s as a nurse's aide in clinical trials. The federal job came with benefits her parents didn't have.
Vacation, you're covered. Sick leave, you're covered. And not being fearful like you are now whether or not you're going to lose your job.
These days, the Trump administration's slashing of government jobs and attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are upending a path into the middle class for many black workers. It began when World War II brought a boom in government jobs.
Black Americans, for the first time, had doors open to them that really weren't open before.
Frederick Gooding Jr. is a historian at Texas Christian University who wrote a book about black federal workers called American Dream Deferred.
It was very difficult for black Americans to find any type of well-paying job, particularly outside of agricultural or domestic endeavors.
But by the 1940s, Gooding says the federal government's merit system offered opportunities that helped a black middle class grow.
Now, the flip side to this is that a good government job was not necessarily a golden ticket.
The federal civil service has had long-standing racial and ethnic pay gaps. Gooding says he's concerned the push by Trump officials to dismantle DEI programs will leave black federal employees in a very vulnerable position when it comes to workplace discrimination. The White House did not respond to NPR's request for comment.
They say cut back!
We say fight back!
Some federal employees are trying to organize, including at the U.S. Postal Service, where, like at many other federal agencies, black people make up about a third of the workforce, while their share of the country's population is around 15%.
My family is under attack. And we're going to fight like hell to make sure that they get their hands off the Postal Service and hands off the Department of Education.
Yeah. Kevin Abernathy helped lead this rally outside D.C. He's a nephew of Shirley Hopkins, who pushed him to apply for his first federal job as a teenager. Now he's a union steward with the National Association of Letter Carriers.
Not too bad. I'll put the day's mail in there.
After more than three decades with USPS, Abernathy delivers on what he calls a retirement route in Maryland.
I love serving the people. Post office has given me everything I have in life. The cars, my home. I raised four kids on this salary.
Until recently, Abernathy's career advice to his kids was consistent.
If they didn't make millions of dollars catching a football or shooting a basketball or whatever, the government is where you want to be.
But his oldest son has decided it's no longer where he wants to be. With the Trump administration pushing to shrink the federal workforce, Abernathy's son left a government job in January to join the private sector. You went into government for stability. Your oldest son left the government for stability.
Yep, different times. Things are changing. We just don't know what the outcome is going to be.
And that means adjusting career advice for his youngest children. He's advising them to look outside the government for now. Hansilo Wong, NPR News.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The new film April follows an OBGYN who travels through rural Georgia, the country bordering Russia, to provide abortions to women. Women who don't have the means to pay for the procedure and, in many cases, were raped. We're going to talk about the film and about that sexual violence for the next 7 or so minutes. The feature was largely shot in secret at a time of increased abortion restrictions in the country. Director Daya Kolumbagashvili told me she was inspired to make this feature after former classmates cut short their education to get married and have kids as teens.
When we were 15, my classmates started to get married, and it was not something they wanted to do, but it was mostly either like encouraged or arranged marriages or kidnappings, which was also kind of part of how the marriages would be arranged. I was very lucky that my father was very critical of all of this, and he kind of made sure that we would not end up getting married this way. And I guess, like, out of luck, because I was born in the family which prioritized my education and my future, I was able to have a profession.
So is this film about choice, about women and choice?
In a way, it is, because, like, even for the character who's assaulted and who's, like, raped repeatedly in the film, and we understand that she had several abortions already, maybe she would want to keep a child, but she doesn't even have that choice.
And this is one of the women that Nina, the main character, the doctor, is repeatedly giving abortions.
Yes.
The woman's mother asks the doctor to give her abortions.
Yes, if a woman gets pregnant as a result of the rape in rural Georgia, most of the times they can't obtain abortions because nobody really cares about how this woman would live with the children, mm-hmm. because it's considered to be a woman's responsibility to take care of a child no matter what. Even if a woman would want to keep this child, she would not be able to do it because it's a shame for the family.
In this part of Georgia, abortions aren't legal?
Officially, abortions are legal, but it's kind of impossible to get an abortion at the end of the day, like especially outside of a capital and outside of like two major or three major cities in Georgia.
So it's not technically illegal, but it's pretty much impossible for young women if they don't go to the big cities.
Yes.
And you embedded in a birthing clinic for this film, right?
Yes. I was able to spend a year there.
A year?
With the doctors, yes.
Wow. I mean, this isn't a documentary. It's a fictional film. Why was it important to spend that much time in a birthing clinic? And you actually film in graphic detail in this movie both a natural birth and a C-section.
It was really invaluable for me as a filmmaker to stay in a clinic for a year with my lead actress and with also other actors and with a cinematographer. And they showed us like what their life really are made of. I did not need to invent anything. I could just see all these people doing something which was so much more important than cinema in a way. And we became part of their process rather than the opposite.
Did you face challenges in Georgia as you made this film and researched this film and shot the film?
Well, yes. I don't even know how to talk about it because film has never been screened in Georgia.
And this film?
Yes. It's been totally kind of hidden and it kind of doesn't exist. And I guess,
why?
Because like it does talk about something which government really doesn't want us to talk about in a way, because I guess like what's the biggest problem now is that government does encourage, in a way, the violence against women because it goes largely unpunished or it goes very mildly punished, I would say. And at the moment, I don't see a possibility to engage this dialogue because I don't think there is readiness from authorities to actually talk about this.
Are you disappointed? I mean, this sounds like what you wanted was to start a conversation.
Yes.
About the things that you witnessed and that you saw and that women went through, and now it can't be screened anywhere in Georgia. And this is a film in your native language about where you grew up.
Yes, there was always a choice that I could make this film outside of Georgia, but it was like a very conscious decision for me. I wanted to make it in the place where I grew up.
With the resistance in Georgia to the film, mm-hmm. do you think you'll be able to make another film in Georgia anytime soon?
No, because I did make this film largely in secret.
Oh.
And I don't think that I would be able to do it again. And I don't know, like, if I go there and make a film about something which would be not addressing any problems or any issues or how people really live, maybe there would be a possibility, but I don't think I would want to do something like that.
Yeah. It was a hard film to watch, honestly, because it's like you're unsettled when you finish the film for a long time over what's happening to these women. Was that purposeful? I mean, just talk about making the film, because it is very artistic. You have these beautiful shots of the rural countryside of Georgia, but then these really, in some cases, violent, in some cases, implicit or explicit images of birth, of abortion. I mean, just talk about what your goal was with the way that you made it.
I guess, like, it's important for me to show it all, because together with the violence, it's important to understand that there is also all this beauty, and it's part of our life there as well. Like, it's true that this film is hard to watch.
Yeah.
And recently I was thinking that maybe only now I started to get out also from the experience of making it, because it was a difficult experience for me as well.
Really?
Yes, because, like, I would see things which obviously maybe are not directly part of the film, but I was going into the houses to talk to women. I could see them having scars and, like, obvious, like, signs of violence in their lives, and then they don't want to talk about it.
So women who are dealing with domestic abuse of some kind?
Yes.
And what would you say is the goal of the film? I mean, when you think about now, it's out in the world and people are watching it. What do you want them to take away from it?
I think we need to be aware that women's rights are not something which are set in stone and which are, like, forever.
Hmm.
Because we're not even, like, done with basically fighting, because big part of our world is still struggling with very basic and very fundamental rights, which women do not have.
Director Dia Kolumbagashvili, her new film, April, is out in theaters now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.